Good morning, happy Sunday, and happy Easter, happy Resurrection Day, whatever you choose to call it, make it a great day. In the Christian world, today is a very important day, one of the most sacred days of the year, as it celebrates the belief in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In the New Testament of the Bible, the event is said to have occurred 3 days after Jesus was crucified by the Romans and died in roughly AD 30. Now, the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead is the core of the Christian gospel. St. Paul says that if Christ is not raised from the dead, then our preaching and hope are in vain. Now, that's 1 Corinthians 15 and 14. Most probably without the resurrection, there would not have been any Christian preaching or faith. You have to remember, the apostles of Christ would have continued to be a disheartened group, which the Gospel of John depicts as being in hiding for fear of the Jews. According to John 20:19, the apostles were in total despair until they met the risen Christ. Then they touched Christ's wounds of the nails and the spear, and they sat and they ate and they drank with him. And then the resurrection, according to Acts 2 and 4, became the foundation of everything that the apostles said and did. For them, the resurrection affirmed Jesus of Nazareth as the prophesied Messiah of Israel and the King and Lord of New Jerusalem, a new heaven and a new earth. So I get it. I completely understand why this day, Easter, is such a celebratory day for Christians around the world. But I understand this as an adult. Now, as a kid, Easter to me, man, I was getting some new clothes, right? We were going to dress up. You know, I don't know what it's like today. It doesn't seem to be as important to kids today to be as sharp as a tack on Easter Sunday as it was for my friends and I. I mean, when I was a kid, we prepped for weeks for Easter. It was a literal competition to see who could come out the flyest. And it was really the only day of the year that I actually wanted to go to church. I wanted to be seen. I knew that it was a celebration. I may not have understood all of the nuances as to why it was a celebration as a child, but I knew everybody was going to be in a good mood, everybody was going to look good, we were going to eat well, and if I didn't get anything else for the rest of the year, I knew I was going to get some new clothes for that day. But you know what? As a kid, there were two things that I never understood, and no one explained to me either. And one of those things is, what does the Easter Bunny have to do with Christ dying on the cross? And the other is, why on Easter Sunday is there purple, the color purple, everywhere on the altar? Well, as it turns out, the origin of the Easter Bunny can be dated back all the way to the 13th century in Germany. The Germanic folk worshiped pagan gods and goddesses, and one of such goddesses was known as Eostre. She was revered as the goddess of fertility and spring. The word Easter finds its etymology from the goddess's name. Due to its prolific breeding tendencies, the rabbit became a symbol for Eostre. At about 595 AD, a long time ago, Pope Gregory sent Roman monks to convert the Anglo-Saxons. The Anglo-Saxons, like German forefathers, celebrated Eostre. Now, when converted, they accepted the celebration of Jesus Christ's resurrection at Easter, while still continuing the celebration of spring renewal and the rabbit's symbolism. Right, so now that takes care of the whole curiosity behind the rabbit. But the other thing I never understood was why the color purple was so significant around the time of Easter. And to understand why the color purple became the color of Lent and Easter, we have to first look at the color's significance in ancient society. Purple dye was a prized commodity in antiquity because it was difficult to obtain. In particular, purple dye was obtained from harvesting certain marine snails. So in light of how labor-intensive it was to produce purple dye, purple apparel became very expensive and often only worn by kings or other royal members, or those with high-ranking authority. As such, the color purple became known as a mark of royalty and sovereignty. The Roman soldiers who tortured Jesus during his quote-unquote passion would have been well aware of the imperial symbolism behind the color purple. This is why in mocking Jesus before his crucifixion, the soldiers dressed Jesus in a purple robe and put a crown of thorns on his head, proceeding to then beat him and yell, "Hail, King of the Jews." So in remembrance of the purple robe the Roman soldiers put on Jesus in mockery, churches display the color purple during Lent to mourn the emotional and physical anguish that Jesus underwent during his passion, and also to proclaim him as the true King of Kings. In some churches, the clergy wear purple vestments, drape lecterns with purple cloths, and cover the entire front of the altars with purple frontals. And that's what I remember as a kid. I remember seeing purple, whether it was in silk or velvet. I remember seeing it being everywhere in the church, especially on the altar. And it made me feel good. For whatever reason, Seeing all of that purple made me feel like the altar was a place for royalty. I mean, it did. And my pastor, who stood on that very important altar of royalty and preached from that pulpit, to me was a person to be revered, respected, and because God shined on him, was never going to tell me anything wrong and was going to keep me safe. That's how I felt. I felt great on Easter Sunday, in particular for those reasons. Now, honestly, as I've gotten older, you know, Easter has become to mean something different for me. And it's primarily because of tragedy. Now, most people suffer tragedy or trauma of some sort in their lives, unfortunately. And depending on the tragedy, the severity of it, or the trauma, the date that you suffer that stays with you. You don't typically forget that date. Well, for me, it was Easter. My mother, my young mother of 36, was killed in a car accident the Monday after Easter Sunday. And like clockwork, no matter how I try to forget it, my mind, like the seasons change, knows when that date is. And no matter what I try to do, it's still emotionally overwhelming for me. And so I seclude myself. I try to stay away from people. I don't want to rain on anybody's parade because I'm typically not in a good mood. I don't want to be bothered with anything. In fact, it was very difficult for me to muster up the motivation to do this show. But like Barnum once famously said, you know, the show must go on. So I had to do my job. I had a show to put together. And initially, I was going to do an entirely different show than the one you're getting today. In fact, I had another guest set up for an interview, the whole nine. And it was completely different from anything that had to do with Easter. I did not want to think about today being Easter. But then the AG's report dropped on Wednesday about priest and molestation. And I've done a show on it before called Wolves in Sheep's Clothing. But this new AG's report is even more disturbing than the initial report. So I felt like I had to speak about it. Like this was not a subject that can be glossed over and certainly not forgotten. And so as I mentioned earlier, like with me, when you suffer tragedy in your or trauma in your life, there are certain days and dates that trigger those memories and those reflections of that trauma. And I can only imagine that because today being such a holy day, especially in the Catholic religion, I can only imagine what the victims of these perverted men, so-called priests, are feeling on a day like today when everyone else is celebrating this day. And you know, I honestly feel that Anthony G. Brown, Maryland's Attorney General, feels similarly to me. Because dropping this report in the middle of what is arguably Catholics' most holy week of the year, the timing is suspect to me. It reeks of, okay, yes, you can have your holy week, but I want to see who you truly are. So I'm going to drop this report right here in the middle of it, and I'm going to see what you do with your congregation. Are you going to tell your parishioners what's going on, what's gone on, what we have found out, or are you going to dismiss it? Because if you do dismiss it, you're not looking for forgiveness. If you do dismiss it, you're not being transparent. If you do dismiss it, you're not educating and trying to prevent this from happening again. So yeah, I'm almost certain that the Attorney General of Maryland, Anthony Brown, is wanting to see what the Catholic organization, all the way from local priests all the way up to the Pope in the Vatican, is going to do with this information that he has dropped in their laps in the holiest of holy weeks. I think that the AG's timing has successfully made this topic for his victims the elephant in the church on Easter Sunday. I think it's brilliant. I think, how do you not, as a priest, get up in the pulpit and not speak on it to your congregation? It speaks volumes if you don't. And it speaks volumes if you do, depending on what you say when you speak on it. You know, one of the other reasons I'm convicted about doing this show is because before and after the first show that I did on this subject, I spoke to a friend of mine that is a victim of priest number 106 on the AG's list. Now, I don't say his name to protect the identity of the priest. I could give a damn about that. Shit, I wish I could scream his name from the mountaintops. I would. I don't say his name to protect the identity of my friend. But my friend told me a story in which after school, he became a policeman. And one day while responding to a call, he walked into a church. And he was face to face after many years with number 106. And he said, "Brian, even with a gun on my hip and a badge on my chest, as a grown man, I was still paralyzed. I was still fearful." That's what trauma does to you. It rarely leaves people. And for many people, it's always bubbling just below the surface. So I called my friend before the show even aired, and we had a conversation. We had a conversation that we had never had about this. We never spoke about this over all of these years, right? But I said to him, though we've never spoken about this, this is going to be my show this week. and I don't want you to be blindsided. If you can, I'd like you to listen to it and tell me what you think and how you feel about what I say and what is spoken about on the show. He said, okay. Then after the show, he told me the story that I just told you guys, and he thanked me for doing the show. He said it made him feel heard, and it made him feel better. So, yeah, I think that the AG's dropping his report in the middle of such a holy week for Catholicism is in large part to help make the victims feel heard in hopes that them feeling heard makes them feel a little bit better. Now, the report itself is over 400 pages long, so obviously I'm not going to read you 400 and some pages of this Attorney General's report. I encourage you to read it on your own, but I'm going to read you just one portion of one page. And it reads, "The ways in which abusers preyed upon their victims varied widely, but all took advantage of the position of authority and respect afforded priests and other clergy in Catholic communities. Parents often gave priests unfettered access to their children because they trusted clergy and spiritual leaders and men of virtue. A victim of Henry O'Toole described what an honor it was to be selected to work in the rectory on Sundays and how proud her family was. When she was alone with him in the rectory, he opened her shirt and fondled her. In the aftermath of a divorce, another victim's mother turned to Jerome Tuohy to provide support and counsel to her son. Tuohy proceeded to sexually abuse the boy for 3 years. John Walewski was another priest who sexually abused children who came to him for counseling. Chillingly, one of his victims was sent to Walewski because of earlier sexual abuse. Robert Hopkins preyed upon an altar boy who volunteered to open the rectory in the morning and assist with the mass. Hopkins was so trusted by the family that the victim's parents let their son sleep overnight at the rectory. Hopkins raped this poor boy for 5 years. One of the most distressing aspects of the abuse is the frequency with which abusers continued their behavior even after victims came forward or concerns were raised. Lawrence Brett admitted in 1964 to the Bridgeport Diocese that he sexually abused and assaulted a boy when he was in Connecticut. He was sent to treatment in New Mexico, where he continued to abuse children, and then came to the Archdiocese of Baltimore, who placed him at the all-boys school Calvert Hall, where he abused over 20 boys after 1964. Joseph Maskell was moved from two parishes in the 1960s because of reports of troubling behavior with children, including a fascination with the sexual fantasies and behavior of Boy Scouts, and having young girls in the rectory under suspicious circumstances. Not only were the reports by multiple parents not investigated, reported to authorities, or publicized, but he was assigned by the same wonderful Archdiocese of Baltimore to be chaplain at Archbishop Keough High School, an all-girls school. It's unbelievable to me. Maskell sexually abused at least 39 victims while there. Walter Imala is another priest who continued to abuse children after victims came forward. He was banished from what became the Diocese of Memphis in 1968 after multiple reports of child abuse were made. But he then came to the Archdiocese of Baltimore and abused at least 6 boys in Maryland, as well as others in Pennsylvania. The duration and scope of the abuse perpetrated by the Catholic clergy was only possible because of the complicity of those charged with leading the church and protecting its faithful. Leaders of the Archdiocese repeatedly dismissed reports of abuse and exhibited little to no concern for victims. They failed to adequately investigate complaints and made no efforts to identify other victims or corroborate alleged abuse. They transferred known abusers to other positions of equal authority or access to children. They focused not on protecting victims or stopping the abuse, but rather on ensuring at all costs that the abuse be kept hidden. Now, I just read you 1.5 pages of a 456-page report. I mean, you have to remember, we're talking about over 600 victims, but only of victims here in Maryland, and only of victims who have reported being abused. You have to also remember that Catholicism is worldwide. There are priests serving all over the world with access to children every single day. So I ask myself, what other organization on the planet could still thrive, could still receive billions of dollars, primarily from donation, every year, tax exempt, by the way, while at the same time having a history of not only mass molestation of thousands of children over the years, but also so evil that they would spend millions of dollars over the years to cover those sins up? The tragic irony is that it is a faith-based organization that, make no mistake about it, judges and controls the behaviors of millions of people based on the Word of God. Think about this. You have a daycare center in your neighborhood, and it services, let's say, 30 children. It takes care of 30 kids a day, and it's been running for 10 years. And then all of a sudden, there is a credible allegation from a parent that their child has been molested or abused at that daycare center. How many days, once it's been proven that the accusation is credible, do you think that their daycare center will stay open and operating? Not one. It would be shut down immediately. So I'm baffled. What is the magic in Catholicism that keeps people giving money to this organization, that keeps them going inside the doors of these Catholic churches when they know the atrocities that this organization has perpetrated? And make no mistake about it, it wasn't just perverted men and priests that kept doing it. It was the leaders of this organization that kept covering it up and moving these perverts from one place to another where they were able to molest and abuse other children. I mean, I've been baffled by this for years, and I don't have the answers. But what I do have is someone who can better help explain it to me and help me understand possibly what I'm missing. I have with me today, again, Dr. Lori Harrison. As you may recall, because she's been on the show a couple of times before, Dr. Harrison is a former pastor and has her own intimate ties and personal relationship with the Catholic Church. So without further ado, please help me welcome back Dr. Lori Harrison. All right, Dr. Harrison, welcome back. Thanks again for being with me this morning. I know Easter is a big day for most people, but certainly for you. So how you doing this morning?
Well, good morning, Brian. Thank you so much for having me back. It's always a pleasure. Hope that you're doing well on this Easter morning.
I am, as well as to be expected. Now, you know why I got you back here. We're going to talk about the AG's report that dropped in the middle of the week. Let me ask you first, what do you think about the timing of the dropping of the report?
Not surprised. not surprised. As a matter of fact, I was sharing with some friends and colleagues that I fully expect, and this was a conversation about 3 weeks ago, that I fully expected that they were going to wait until Holy Week to drop the report. So no surprise there.
Real quick, for people who didn't hear the last show that we did about this, what is your connection to the Catholic Church?
I was literally born into the faith. And I say that figuratively and literally. I'm growing up in Baltimore, and understanding for your listeners that Baltimore is one of four major hubs for Black Catholics in the country. Both my mother and father were Catholic, so it was something that I came up in. And you know, given what we're talking about today, you know, my experience was polar opposite of what we're about to talk about in terms of the sex abuse that went on in the church. Polar opposite until a certain point. I think I shared with your listeners last go around that I did have an unfortunate experience, not molested by a priest, but molested by a member of a Catholic church, and went to one of the priests that is on the list as the credibly accused, who shut me down completely. And now we know that happened, and I don't mind calling his name out. He is no longer amongst living on this side, but the former Father Carl Fisher, who was pastor at St. Francis Xavier in Baltimore. So it is rooted within my upbringing and my spiritual formation.
So you say both your mom and your dad were Catholic. Mm-hmm. Now, you didn't necessarily separate yourself from the Catholic Church, but you did go on to become a pastor of a Protestant church. Is that right?
I know. It sounds crazy, right? But yes, I did. Yes, I did. I followed, and I'm putting this in air quotes for your listeners, the call of God. Didn't really understand it all the time because I only knew Catholicism, and I sure enough was not going to become a nun. Because, again, you know, wasn't interested in living a life of celibacy, just loved God and wanted to serve God. So, you know, the route to that for me was Protestantism. Stopped going to Mass for a few years, for sure, but never disconnected totally with the church. And then in the midst of my own vocation as a pastor, picked up somewhere around 2010 and started going back to Mass on Saturdays for this reason. When you're in the public eye, in a pastoral role, you don't get to sit back and absorb the word on Sunday mornings because right. you're the one giving it.
Right.
And so it was my place of quiet, peace, solace, and a familiar spiritual connection.
So as someone who was, I'm sure, aware, like this is new to most people, this AG report, you know, the whole sexual abuse and misconduct of priests in the Catholic Church isn't a new thing, and it isn't new to
Correct.
Most people, especially people within the Catholic organization and parishioners. So as a pastor and someone who had ties to the Catholic Church, how did you reconcile what was going on when you were still going to Mass on Saturdays? Is it something you even thought about?
So, yeah, I did. But here's the thing. So when I think it's been like, 22 years when the Boston Globe did their big expose
right.
on the Catholic Church. You know, at that point, I think it's like anything else. You know, you hear it. It's scathing, but very differently than what has happened here, at least to my knowledge. Maybe a report was out there. I never had my hands on a graphic report like the Attorney General from Maryland's graphic report that was released on Wednesday. The other thing, too, is like anything else that we see in the news, reports of horror, death, destruction. I think, you know, when you hear it so much, you kind of get a mental callus built up towards it.
Okay.
So you hear it. It's horrible. You know, you heard it the first time outside of the United States. You heard it in Philadelphia. Boston, I think then Philadelphia, but now the chickens have come home to roost in Baltimore. And why that is significant, outside of the fact that this is one of the major hubs for Black Catholics, outside of the fact that historically, Baltimore, when the newfound, the newcomers to this new world that they thought that they found, we know that there's another historical revisionist history where
right,
that's concerned.
Right.
When they came this way and the Catholic contingency separated from the Catholic Church in England, Baltimore became the archdiocese for what we now know as the United States.
Okay.
And so for quite some time, this was it. This was like Catholic Central for everybody that was practicing Catholicism at that time. And so it holds a whole, you know, another level of significance historically. But I think the difference for me, it's not that I didn't think about it. I mean, I certainly, for me, when we got to, I guess, the, and I think I talked about this the last time that I was on your show, when the reports got released in France, at that point I had it because, you know, it's like how deep does this go? How much more are we going to hear? And at that point, and that's been several years ago when the reports came out about the sex abuse of children in France, I was at the point of being done. My head was, I can't say the word on your show, but my head was just above all of the shiggity that was going on.
Right.
But when we talked, I believe it was in November, when the AG's office made the request to have this full report released.
Right.
It reached a whole nother level. And I got to say, you know, I was on a wait and see mode. I got the report in my hands to read on Wednesday of this week. And I got to tell you, Brian, I was not expecting the graphic nature of details that's listed therein.
Yeah, it's insane, really. And the insanity just doesn't lie in the fact that these perverted men did what they did to these children. But how far up the chain it went to cover all of this stuff up.
Exactly.
That's what makes it the scandal. You know, the tragedies are the tragedies, but the cover-up is what makes it the scandal and makes, to me, the entire organization look horrible. Because you can't really control what people do all of the time when you're dealing with an organization as big as the Catholic Church. But what you can do is be responsible and accountable once you find out what happens. And none of that was going on. And that's what makes it so horrible for me. So,
and we take that up to, like, I don't want to misquote from the report, but I think up until like 2004, before those in power within the archdiocese completely began to get on board.
Right. Right.
And get on board with doing the right thing. Get on board with following the legal practices that needed to be taking place in terms of reporting sexual abuse, that kind of thing.
Right. Now, you have, I think, spoken to a priest since we've spoken in November.
I have.
And what kind
of, yes.
What's the skinny?
Let me just say this because I'm really trying to be as balanced as I can with this.
Okay.
I've spoken to two.
Okay.
And I count both of them as friends of mine. And let me just say for your listeners, neither one are on this list. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing.
I'm not having conversations with the credibly accused.
Okay.
I think the last conversation I had was in December with one of them. And we kind of went back and forth in terms of me talking about where I was having serious issues, him understanding why I was having the serious issues, and really not coming to any kind of decision, because at that point I decided that I was going to wait and see what the report said.
Okay.
Now, to his credit, you know, he has addressed it openly at Mass. He has made no excuses for what has happened. As a matter of fact, he has urged parishioners not to try to defend the indefensible. But yet and still, I mean, you know, I can't lie to say that there is not still a great tension for me. And the tension is not with what has happened. The tension is not with the fact that I think those that are able to still be prosecuted need to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. I am right there on all that.
Okay. All right.
The tension comes in, and I think this is where the tension is going to come in for most Catholics in Baltimore, is how do I come to some sense of peace about my participation as a Catholic? So we're talking about the tension between spiritual, personal spiritual practices versus the institution.
Right.
And I'm not suggesting that you can separate them. I'm saying that most folks who have lived their lives as Catholics, living out the faith without knowing that this stuff was going on, are sitting and saying, okay, now what do I do?
Right. So, and that's my thing. My thing is, as a Catholic priest, and I've said this to you before, as a Catholic priest, when you get up in the morning, you put on that collar, and you know that you're representing not just the good, but you're representing the awful as well. How do you continue to recruit members when this has not been something that is in the forefront of the Vatican? Like, the Vatican speaks on this when it has to, it seems.
Right.
Other than that, though, you don't hear of any workshops. You don't hear of anything that's going on to either lessen or cut out or anything to stop what's been going on as far as children being molested in this organization. So I'm trying to figure out, where are the priests that are not just speaking on this when they have to, but speaking on this because they need to and it's the right thing to do? If you're not doing that, how good of a person, not just a priest, but how good of a person are you when you're in that organization?
Right. And, you know, not being a priest, I can't answer that. The only thing I think that I can add to or answer around your very valid question is in terms of me having those discussions with the two priests that I consider to be friends, I would say one more than the other, has talked about it, not because it's just, you know, necessary or they're pushed to talk about it, because right. as I have talked to friends of mine who still, you know, practice of faith and are not necessarily in Black Catholic churches, in mixed denominations. I've checked with one person, a very good friend of mine, who, you know, has gone to church, you know, every day during Holy Week, is not willing to give up on her Catholic faith. And that was my first question, you know, starting with, you know, Holy Thursday is when the services for most Catholics begin during Holy Week. And I asked the question, what happened in church today, tonight?
Right.
You know, did
right.
your pastor bring this up? Well, no. But when the prayers of the faithful, you know, prayed for those that have been abused, I said, okay. Mm-mm. So, you know, to me, and even in her response, you know, and I'm sure she's trying to defend, you know, in some senses, the indefensible. She said, well, you know, he probably won't touch on Sunday because, you know, it's Easter, but he'll get to it, you know, the following Sunday. And I challenged her. I said, do you hear how wrong that sounds coming out of your mouth?
Right.
I mean, to me, it does, you know, because I think that it was intentional to drop the report when it did. You know, I don't really make any kind of allowances in terms of, you know, was it done intentionally, you know, to make sure. I mean, my feeling is, yes, it was, because, you know, you're right on the cusp of the holiest day out of the year, not just for Catholics, but for Christians.
Right. Well I made allowances Easter. For it. I made allowances for it in my opening. I don't know if you heard it, but I spoke about the timing of it and how suspect it was
okay.
and how right on point I think it is, and how I think that it was done to absolutely make this subject the elephant in the church on Easter
yeah.
Sunday.
I mean,
I do. So,
and I don't, and I hear what you're saying, and I definitely lean completely in the direction that you're talking about. Hence the fact of me telling you at the beginning of our time together today that I was saying this 3 weeks ago, it's going to drop Holy Week.
Right.
I don't know when, but it's going to be right before Easter. You know, to cause priests to either deal with it or act like it's not there.
Right. And based on what you do in light of this dropping, it'll tell a whole lot about who you are.
It absolutely will.
You know.
So it absolutely will.
So where are you in, because you still do some preaching from time to time or speaking from time to time.
I do.
So where are you? Like, what is your conviction as far as talking about this? Do you feel, because here's the deal. We talk mm-hmm. about gun control and about how it now is affecting our children. Now that it is the number one killer among young people in the country. We talk about how we need to have stricter gun laws and be more intentional in what we do with guns to protect our children. Right. It's a big
right.
thing. Where are we in reference to this situation? How do we address it? Because I don't know how comfortable people should be with children, not just in the Catholic Church now. I mean, by and large is with the Catholic Church. But let's be honest. I mean, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, right?
And
fortunately, in the church, pastors and preachers have a lot of power,
mm-hmm.
and it causes a lot of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And
the power doesn't cause the corruption. I'm going to push back on that for just a second. It's those who pervert or abuse the power
okay.
that causes the corruption.
That's fair.
Because I think there are people that are in positions of leadership in the church that use their power and use it well. Use it for the benefit of people. Use it to help people. And I don't want that to get lost in the midst of what you're saying.
Okay, I got you. That's fair enough. But where do you feel convicted in speaking about this, or do you?
I do, to everybody that will listen. So just to give you an example, you know, I said that on both sides of my family, pretty much everybody's Catholic. Okay. Right. I had a conversation yesterday morning with a cousin of mine who's very active in his Black Catholic Church. And we started talking about the support. And at first he said to me, well, you know, I'm not, I ain't going to read it, you know, because Lori, I already know what's in there.
Right.
And I said to him, wait a minute. I said, before you shrug that off, and he wasn't shrugging off the issue, but saying, I don't need to read it. I said, oh, no, I think you do. I said, let me give you some of the graphic language that is in the report about a former priest that you know and know well. And when I started paraphrasing what is in this report, but using the specific and exact language of sexually abusing boys with, and I hope that I can say this on your show.
Yeah, of course you can.
But, you know, I was clutching my own pearls when I was reading case after case,
right,
that, you know, young boys were orally raped and anally raped,
right,
from ages 6 all the way, you know, into early adulthood.
Right.
And when I started sharing the details, my cousin said, wait, what? And finally I said, can I send it to you? Let me send it to you so that you can read it for yourself. And so, yeah, I feel like I do have, I'm convicted to draw people to the table to talk about it. And I do understand, I had a conversation with another friend of mine who has been, you know, a cradle, as we used to call a cradle Catholic, you know,
right,
just born
right
into this, cradle Catholic, who is a bit older than I am, and said, you know, I hear you. And I can respect this. She said, I'm going to read it. I'm not ready to read it yet because you're talking, this is talking about my age group, the people that I grew up with, not only that I grew up with in terms of friends in the church, but I knew, from her standpoint, she knew many of the Black priests back in the 70s, because back during that time, Brian, there was a cadre of priests, about 10 or 12, in seminary, coming out all at the same time, around the same time.
Right.
And that was in conjunction with the Black Power movement within the Catholic Church.
Right.
Where Black Catholics were beginning to say, on the heels of the national Black Power movement, you know what? No, we need Mass. It's got our music in it. We need to be in service where it is culturally connected for us. So all of that was happening at the same time. And, you know, I quoted some other pieces from the report to her, and I said, I understand that you're not ready to read it yet, but I think that every Catholic owes it to themselves, as hard as it is to digest, to read it and to understand the gravity of what has happened.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, because I was shocked as I was reading. I found out that the person that was my pastor when I was like, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years old was on the list.
Exactly.
And, you know, he abused a 14-year-old girl. But, Brian, that young lady ended up committing suicide.
Ugh.
As many of these victims did, because
absolutely,
they just could not handle. And who could handle the fact that the person that you look at as being your direct connect to the Almighty is telling you, you got to do this, you know, or you and your family are going to hell.
Right.
Or you have to do this because God wants you to do it, perverting the very thing that some of these children, many of these children, you know, adhere to in a very devout manner.
Right. You know, it was heartbreaking for me that the only two Catholic priests that are Black that I knew are both on this list.
They on the
Maurice
list.
Blackwell and J. Glenn Murray. So
yep,
for me, I completely disillusioned. I'm like, I can't.
I'm sure.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't understand. And the thing is when things go on for decades, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And decades and decades and decades, and nothing is done, most people give up hope that anything will ever be done. And I'm sure that's how a lot of these victims feel and felt.
Right.
And so, like, Blackwell's victim took it into his own hands, right? And
one of them.
Right. And shot him. But it should never have to get to that point.
No.
And I'm trying to figure out, like, the question I asked is, at what point does an organization become so dismissive of horrible, abhorrent behavior that mm-hmm. it has to be shut down? What does it take?
Yeah, so I don't know the answer to your question, because I think I feel pretty assured that it's not going to be shut down.
Right.
But, you know, I guess the question for me is, where is the completely authentic reform of the church coming into play? That's what I am waiting to see. I ain't waiting that long, but that's what I'm waiting to see, because, you know, I will say this publicly. I am not a fan of Archbishop Lori. I think he is blowing smoke.
Right.
And the
right.
reason that I say that is because while he has posted videos apologizing since November and prior to that, to let me be clear, prior to that, you know, even when some of the first reports were coming out and when they first began to post or to list the credibly accused on the Archdiocese website, yes, apologies are coming. Here's where I had the problem, though. I could accept that. I could accept that, you know what, we have a horrible past, but we're going to turn over, we're going to strive to turn over a new leaf. The United States has a horrible past with racism, has a horrible past with the treatment of blacks in this country.
Right.
Pieces and parts, it's been a slow wheel turning to turn over a new leaf, so to speak. Where I have the issue is I would feel better about, okay, things got put in place and we have not, to our knowledge, had any other abuses happen after 2004. I would feel, so, you know, almost 20 years. I would feel better about that if I didn't know that while Archbishop Lori is saying on the one hand, or at least this is prior to the report coming out, we're not, the Archdiocese is not going to stand in the way of the full report coming out. You know, the victims are owed this, blah, 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 blah. And towards the end of November, look it up, there was an article that appeared in the Washington Post by an attorney who herself was a victim of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, who then went into, became an attorney and began to defend and become the attorney for those who had been abused, who said in this article that it was bullshit stuff that the Archdiocese was talking about, because they had paid like up to $200,000 to hire other attorneys to keep this report secret.
Right.
So, you know, when I hear that, it doesn't settle well. It just doesn't settle well.
So where are you now? Like, where are you now in reference to being associated or in alignment with the Catholic Church? How is your spirit? When was the last time you went to Mass, if I may ask?
You may ask, and I went on Thursday.
Oh, wow, okay.
I went on Thursday because, for two reasons, Brian. One was because I wanted to see how and if it was going to be addressed from the pulpit. That was one.
And how was it addressed?
I also went because Holy Week has always been spiritually a special time for me. And I know that you are aware that my mother passed away a little over a year ago.
Yes.
My mother and I, and here's the thing, you know, my mother and I were as thick as thieves. We were as tight as a mother and daughter could possibly be. One of the things that we shared over the course of my lifetime was our faith. And so I went because in missing her especially this week at this time of year leading up to Easter, for all the things that we used to do together. I went because I wanted to feel close to her in that sense. Now, I got to tell you, you know, it was raining here in Baltimore on Thursday night. I almost did not go. And I have to say, you know, I sat in church and I was conflicted the whole time.
Okay.
I really was. I had good memories of being in that space with my mother.
Okay.
Good memories that brought me to the point of tears, but they were good memories. At the same time, I'm thinking, and this is a place that this child was abused over in the next building. This is the place where this another child was, you know, abused in a classroom, sexually
right.
abused.
Right.
It was that happened before I began attending, but I was conflicted, and you know, there was a, as happens in many churches, not just Catholic churches, as people recount Jesus's steps and works and actions leading to Good Friday and then to Easter Sunday, you know, there's a foot washing ceremony. And I just, I couldn't participate.
Wow.
I couldn't make myself participate
yeah.
because the message that was being given by the priest that I respect as a person, I could understand his message from an intellectual standpoint in terms of, you know, we are always called to love, even those that are the credibly accused, you know, because Jesus would wash their feet, would you? I don't know. I don't know. I really just don't know. And so, I mean, we are friends. After Mass was over, you know, he came up behind me, we embraced, and he said, I know this was difficult for you, but I'm glad that you came. And I know that he meant that. But I didn't go back yesterday. Okay. And I made the choice not to go back yesterday. Now we're at Sunday morning. And, you know, I have my own preaching engagement this morning. So
right.
I will not be, you know, at Mass. But trust and believe, I will be coming back to YouTube to check out what was said to the congregation. Because that will be telling. If this is skipped over, that's going to be a problem. And if it's skipped over, whether it's skipped over or not, I'm due for another conversation with him.
I know that you are. I know that you are.
Absolutely.
I am. See, unlike you, although I become analytical in situations like this,
mm-hmm.
I become angry in situations and frustrated.
Absolutely.
Because my ties aren't as deep in that religion as yours are. And I've been hearing about it, you know, for years. You know,
right,
I remember
right.
60 Minutes doing a piece on it about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I sat with my grandfather, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I'm like, how is this going on?
Like,
we couldn't understand it. Because I also remember about 15 years ago, and I almost said, and I said this in my opening as well, that there was a daycare center that was servicing 30 kids. One kid was alleged to have been abused by one of the workers. And after being in service for 10 years, that daycare center was shut down the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have
mm-hmm.
thousands of children
mm-hmm.
Around the world, and 600 in this state alone.
That we know about.
That we know about.
Yeah.
And this organization is still going strong, tax exempt,
yeah.
billions a year. I don't understand it. I don't
yeah.
understand it.
Yeah. And I don't know that whoever will. And when I need your listeners to know that, you know, the majority of sex abuse cases, instances, are never reported to the police.
Right.
And you might think that is crazy. You know, when it happened to me, you know, as a teenager, I did not report it to the police because there's so much shame and there's so just, you know, especially when you know the abuse, it's just so much that comes along with that. But your listeners also need to know that the numbers go down even further for children of sexual abuse.
Right.
That only like 11.9% of all cases for children get reported.
Jeez. So
I mean, we can talk about this all day.
Yeah, there's a ton that still has not been, that we still don't know about.
Exactly.
It's a shame. Well, listen, I am so thankful that you gave me the time you gave me today. I know it's a busy day for you.
I appreciate you coming on.
It's always my pleasure. And you'll be back again. Because like you said.
Well, I certainly look forward to it, Brian. Look, I hope that you have a wonderful and blessed Easter today. And I hope your listeners do as well. You told me last time that I was an official member of the 1500
you
radio
absolutely
family.
Are.
So I'm looking to be coming back sooner rather than later.
Appreciate you, Doctor. You have an amazing Easter Sunday.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I am always so thankful to have Dr. Hairston come on. She explains things so well, and she's so passionate about what she says and what she does, so I'm very thankful for her. But I know that you hear the music. It means that it is time for the Petty. Let's give him a call and see what he's talking about today.
Good morning, Brother B. Brother B, happy Easter to you.
Same to you, partner. It is the Petty. The Petty is upon us. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm feeling fantastic. Let me tell you something, Brother B. We've seen it in the NFL, and I'm telling you, I mentioned it the last time we spoke about that trap game, and it happened.
Yeah, the Defenders, yeah. Yeah, they
the
lost.
Defenders, they fell to the winless Guardians, and I'm telling you, the Guardians put on a hell of a show. They played like it was their last game. Basically, that was their championship game. Beating the Defenders, and I really think the Defenders were kind of overlooking them. They figured it was like an easy game for them to, you know, walk in the park, and they found out that you got to play the game every week.
I mean, you called it. You called it last week. You said it was going to happen, and it happened.
And you know what? The Defenders are not out of the woods yet because they have to travel to Seattle to play what is now the hottest team in the league. I'm talking about those Sea Dragons. They're going out to Seattle to play the Sea Dragons tonight. And I'm telling you, that should, everybody in Seattle should get a ticket. I mean, it's going to be a great game out there. And possibly the Sea Dragons could be the crop, cream of the crop of the league if they defeat the Defenders.
I think the best thing that could have happened to the Defenders is that they did lose that game last week, because they will be on guard for the Sea Dragons tonight. I don't think they'll lose tonight.
Well, I hope so, because the Sea Dragons, the only other game that's going on today will be the Roughnecks, who seem to be falling on hard times. They will travel across town to see their Texas brothers, the San Antonio Brahmas. And yesterday, there were some exciting games. The Vipers took the Battlehawks into overtime.
Yeah.
And the Battlehawks came out to be victorious. And another good game, those Guardians that were flying high off of that one over the Defenders almost pulled it out against the Renegades. But they fell short. So I'm telling you, Brother B, there's some good games being played here in the spring. So everybody just don't give up on the XFL yet. And in about a week or so, we'll be watching the USFL start up.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how much talent is left out there. Like, you got a lot of talent in the XFL, but I mean, not enough talent from the XFL that they could play in the NFL. And now you've got the USFL. I'm trying to figure out where are they pulling the talent from there?
Well, there's a special on ESPN on Thursday evenings called The 54th Man, and that really talks about the guys who can't make it on the practice squad on the NFL team, so they usually end up going to a USFL or XFL team. So that might be something people might want to look at to find out where all this talent is coming from, like yourself.
Yeah, it's called The 54th Man.
The 54th Man.
I'm going to check it out.
It's something you should look at, and you get an idea. It's like, this is where all this talent is coming from. There's some talented players in the XFL. There are definitely going to be some talented players in USFL. There have been a lot of former NFL players who are still trying to, you know, find their way back into the NFL. So what they're doing is that they're signing with teams on the XFL and the USFL.
Right.
Hoping to display their talents and getting another shot at the NFL.
You know, I kind of want to switch gears a little bit, because I know we talk about the NFL, the XFL, the USFL. Have you been paying attention at all to the March Madness championship game between LSU and Iowa and Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, that whole situation?
I want to talk about it, but then again, it's like, to me, it's not a big talking point. I mean, it was a women's basketball game, a women's championship game, a very well-played women's basketball championship game, but they're making a big deal over the Caitlin Clark and the Angel Reese scenario. And it shouldn't be, because if it was two guys doing the same thing,
we'd be
talking
no big deal.
About it. We'd be
right.
Talking about the game. And you know why everyone is talking about it.
Oh, yeah, it's you know, there's a racial component to it as well.
Of course it is.
Right.
I mean, it's a component to it because it's women, and I guess people think women should not be that competitive. But then again, it's someone that's a white individual and a black individual.
Right.
So there you have that scenario also. But to me, if it was just two guys, it wouldn't be a big talking point.
Well, you know why Angel Reese is dear to me is because she graduated from my alma mater. She graduated from St. Francis. So,
and she also was a player at the University of Maryland. She transferred to LSU.
Right, right, right.
So I get it. I understand that. But actually, she's a very good player. Caitlin Clark is a very good player. They're two good players. Hopefully, they'll see each other again in competition. And it's just like, just let it go.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen some of the comments. And it's more or less that when Caitlin Clark did it, because she did the exact same thing,
right?
Nobody said anything. But when Angel Reese did it, now it's a big deal. It should not have been a big deal.
I agree. What do you think about Jill Biden inviting both teams to the White House instead of just the winner?
Well, I think that's really to appease Iowa and Caitlin Clark, because she's deemed the best basketball player in the nation, best women's basketball player in the nation. But in past scenarios in history, it's always been the winner. So why all of a sudden we're riding both teams?
Do you think that there's a...
If you want to set a precedent, do that. Then, okay, in the future, let's invite all of the champions and the runner-ups. Nobody's talking about the runner-ups. They're always talking about the champions.
Exactly.
Nobody wants to be thinking about the team that lost, because if that's the case, we'd be talking about all the teams that lost in championship games. And what's there to talk about? You lost.
Right.
Take your loss and think about the next season where you're going to try to win it again.
No, I agree.
So I don't think it's a good idea. I think you should just say, look, LSU, you're coming to the White House, and that's it. That's just my opinion.
Have you heard anything more about Lamar Jackson?
Well, the biggest thing with Lamar Jackson soap opera saga, whatever you want to call it, is more or less that he said he requested a trade. The Ravens don't want to let him go. We're at the impasse as far as contract talks. I think Lamar is being punished for what Cleveland did with Deshaun Watson. Who guarantees a player that much money and they really haven't shown that they've earned it?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that Deshaun Watson is not a good player. I think he's an excellent quarterback, but what has he done to want that type of money from a team?
Nada. Nothing.
And I feel like it's so unfortunate that Lamar Jackson has to pay the penalty for what Cleveland gave to Watson. Now, on the flip side of that same token, Lamar Jackson is not showing up when it's necessary. He's not staying healthy. He's not playing a whole season when the Ravens need him to play full season.
So he hasn't helped his situation at all in that regard.
No, well, the biggest thing is that he doesn't have an agent.
And right.
He doesn't have an agent. He can't stay healthy. They can't get out of the first round. And here's the big thing. He doesn't have the talent around him so that he can stay healthy, where he doesn't have to always run the ball. He doesn't really have to. I mean, look at the receiving corps they have now. I mean, do you really think he's going to light it up? Is something really going to be different with the Ravens, where it's going to say, well, yes, Lamar Jackson is worth that money?
Right, right.
I honestly believe that yes, he should get a $200 million contract, but, you know, kind of take what they give you, sign a short-term deal, and say, okay, I want to play a 16-game season. I'm going to get us hopefully to the AFC Championship, maybe even to a Super Bowl, and hopefully I will do it when my contract is about to expire. Then they have to pay me.
Right.
Because if you can remember the last time that the Ravens won the Super Bowl, Joe Flacco was the quarterback.
Yeah, he was. And they paid him a boatload of money.
They gave him a boatload of money because he was a Super Bowl MVP.
Right,
and he was coming up on the contract year. And after Joe Flacco got his money,
he was nothing.
He became a bum.
He was a bum.
So, and I'm not saying Lamar Jackson's going to do that. Patrick Mahomes didn't do it. He got his big contract extension. There are quarterbacks out there that's going to get that money. And maybe Lamar should have taken what the Ravens offered him, or came back with a counter offer saying, look, I don't want 4, 5, 6 years. Give me a 2-year contract with X amount of money that's guaranteed. Ball out for those 2 years. You're still young. Then you hit him with the big money.
Right. Well, we will see. We will see what happens. I'm definitely going to watch the XFL games tonight, today and tonight. I'm definitely vested. Invested in the DC Defenders emotionally. And who do you pick for that game?
Well, you know, the line is Seattle -2. And they're home. And if that crowd shows up and just display their enthusiasm for the Sea Dragons the way that the crowd does for the Seahawks, I'm going to have to go with the Sea Dragons.
Ooh, really?
But let me tell you this, Brother B. I watched the game yesterday between the Guardians and the Renegades. And the Guardians just pulled up probably one of the biggest upsets in the XFL. And there were so many empty seats there. I would think that they would come out and support their team after they have just defeated what was the undefeated team in the league.
Right.
What was considered the best team in the league.
Right.
And I was just shocked. Yes, they are a 1-7 team, but they have talent. Yes, they make some mistakes, but they have talent. The tickets do not cost that much.
No, they're not at all.
It's your opportunity to go see a team play.
Right.
And
right.
I don't get so. I like the Defenders. That's
okay.
The team I'm picking to win the XFL championship. But those Sea Dragons, they are hot right now. I mean, they are the hottest team in the league. They're on that 5-game winning streak. I don't know, Brother B. It might be tough for DC to go all the way out there in Seattle. I'm just saying, that's one you might want to watch. 7 p.m. tonight.
I'm going to check it out. I'm definitely going to check it out, brother. I appreciate you. I really do.
And let's keep our ears and eyes open with the Lamar situation, because with the NFL draft closely approaching, the Ravens might be trying to make some moves to unload Lamar to a team. Pick up some draft picks, get a quarterback that's serviceable, and work from there. This might be a time where if they do not retain Lamar Jackson, that the Baltimore organization may be thinking about a whole total rebuild.
I'll definitely keep my eyes and my ears open.
Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. I gotta go. I will talk to you next week. If I hear anything,
all right, brother.
You'll hear it first, brother.
All right, brother.
Peace.
Peace, man. All right. Well, you heard from the Petty. You heard it from the Petty's mouth. He is picking the Defenders to win this evening. In fact, he's picking for the Defenders, the DC Defenders, to win everything in the XFL, including the championship game. And I promise you, I don't disagree. But he's gone, and I want to say one thing before I leave. Actually, I want to say a couple of things, but I'll make them brief. Last week, I spoke about Tennessee's gun laws and how lax they are and how it needed to be changed, especially after the elementary school that was shot up in Tennessee the week before. Well, two Democratic members of the Tennessee House of Representatives were expelled, while a third one, who was also in agreement with these other two, was spared. The only difference between the three is that the two gentlemen that were expelled were black, and the one that was spared is white. Representative Justin Jones and Justin Pearson were both expelled, both young black lawmakers who were voted into office by their constituents to represent them for advocating for stricter gun laws within that state. Now, here's the thing. Though the look of racism in this situation in particular is obvious, everyone sees it. It's not even something that's really debatable. These two young men have still not been reinstated. Now, they are eligible to be re-voted in, which is probably what will happen. But the mere fact that this can happen in 2023, what I'm saying to you is pay attention. Please pay attention. Southern states are doing things that are reminiscent of the 1940s and 50s and 60s. Do you know that Tennessee actually had a member try to reinstate lynching. This is no joke. And that representative is still an active member, still voting on laws within the state of Tennessee. That's how backwards things have gotten. And we're not paying attention. All right, well, listen, it is Easter Sunday. I've got to go. I hope that everyone has a great and safe Easter Sunday. And please remember to get at me on IG at On with Brian Pettaway. I'd love to hear your feedback. Tell me what you think of today's show. Tell me what you think of the AG's report. And please read it. You will be blown away with what you read. Things that I can't even mention on this show, believe it or not. So listen, have a great day. Get back to work on Monday. Stir some things up. But I got to go. Peace.